Woodworkers for the Blind presents a conversation on tools we purchased but just didn't turn out the way we thought they would, or they were just a waste of money. Well, we have a conversation on this and about some tools that were a great investment.
And you can find Woodworkers for the Blind on the web at www4b.org. A lot of blind and visually impaired woodworkers sharing ideas, thoughts, projects, and a lot of how-to-dos. And now our host, Daryl Vickers, will take it away.
He was just dumbfounded. He says, that's way too easy.
Wrong mortise and tenon, George.
Jeff, I'm going to think about it now.
Sounded like a real good idea until I got it home and tried it, and it didn't work.
The gears just stripped right out. I didn't even get to drill one hole with it.
It went to junk pile real quick.
If we ever have another group meeting, I'll bring my Jessam doweling jigs. I think it's the best thing since sliced bread.
The recording going?
Yes, the recording is now going. Daryl, oh, mighty woodworker. And by the way, you're looking good tonight.
All right. Good evening, everybody. This is our monthly woodworking call. Tonight, we're going to talk about things we purchased that maybe we didn't need or didn't work as expected or perhaps could have lived without, that kind of thing. We could also mix in a really useful one if you happen to have one that we haven't covered before. A couple of announcements that Miss Leslie, who's on the call tonight, will be our guest in December. And I am working with a company called Ridge Carbide, who makes router bits and really nice saw blades for January. And then Stockroom Supply, who makes that drum sander and other things that we bought. I'm trying, hopefully getting them the first part of the year too sometime. So we have some, I think, some pretty good shows coming up in the near future. Hi, Mr. Jeff. Do you have anything, sir?
Everything's going good. Glad you all can make it here. And everyone's sounding good.
Yeah, I've had an interesting week. A couple of weeks ago, I went to Lowe's to buy some carpeting with insulation, and I came out with a luxury plank and doing it myself. So my house is just a giant mess right now. And that's the story of Daryl's life.
Is that a click together stuff, or is it this the individual planks you glue down?
No, it's the float, the click together stuff. That.
Okay.
Or are you cutting it?
With my table saw.
A lot of those, you score them and snap them.
Yeah, you can do that. I just honestly just got started today actually laying it. Lowe's had messed me up on my order and they didn't get it till yesterday. So I just started today. So I cut out the heat registers and stuff like that with a jigsaw, but going to use my table saw with the bigger pieces. Now it's started here and I apologize if I digressed. I'm just having a day too. Mr. George Wurzel, you were about to say...
My turn. Oh, goody, 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 goody.
You sounded so excited about this neat thing that you got, apparently.
Well, it's interesting because I just saw somebody's post for a base that goes on the bottom of your router so that when you put your router down, it automatically centers the router bit in the piece that you're working with for making like little grooves or mortises in the edges of pieces. And the one I saw, they were asking $100 and some for it. And you take off the base on your router, and then you have to fuss with this thing and get it to mount to the bottom of your router and everything. And it basically is a plastic plate that has two pegs on it that when you set, you use a, with a plunge router, when you set it down on the board, you twist it until one of the pegs is on each side of the board. And that automatically puts the router bit dead center in the middle of your board. So we went $100 and some for this. A couple of years ago, I needed to do some mortises in the middle of the board with the plunge router like that. And I thought, now how can one someone do this? So I took out two of the screws that mount the base on my router. And I went to the hardware store and I bought two bolts that had that same thread as those of the bolts that hold the plate, face plate, into the router base. And then I walked over to the bin where they had different things, and I bought two roller ball bearings that happened to have the same diameter as the bolts that I just bought. And I put those two bearings, one on each one of the bolts, and put a washer on each side that the bearing could spin freely. And I screwed those two screws back into my router base. So now I have a router base that has two pegs that stick out on the bottom of it that have a roller bearing on each side. And I see now, probably my $9 that I spent or $10 that I spent to buy these two bolts and these two bearings and four washers, I made something that was worth $100. And I thought, why would anybody buy this tool when they can just go to the hardware store? And it flashed through my mind is because most people expect someone else to solve their problems. They have a need and they look around and they say, what does someone else have that solves problems? And I attribute a lot of things that I do in my shop and that work out well, and the things that turn out totally bad as well, to being a blind person, because I think that we really do learn to think differently than sighted people. In our quest to create the same result as other people do, we are inspired to find ways, come hell or high water, to come out with the same result as other people do that are doing visually oriented things, to do in the way that works for us. I think all of us in this group, especially who do woodworking, who are blind, I think if we sat down and compared what we do with our sighted peers, it doesn't take very long to figure out that we're probably in our machining and our jig and our fixture building and those kinds of things, we probably have higher skill levels than the average guy of the same experience level as the average sighted guy with the same experience level. But just because our blindness forces us to be more creative about how we approach things. It's approach is the whole thing. We look at things, I want to accomplish X, and the guy who can see just pulls out his little pocket Fellini ruler and makes his little marks and goes and zing-zang and does it. And we look at that and say, I want to accomplish the same thing. How do I do that? I can't see those little marks. What can I do to accomplish that? Another good thing that I see people struggle with all the time who are sighted is when you want to mount a faceplate on a piece of wood to mount on your lathe, when you want to use a faceplate, people spend a lot of time dinking around and trying to center that faceplate onto what they're working on. And I figured out one day that all I needed to do is put a dot in the middle, a tactile reference with an awl in the middle of where I want dead center to be. All the faceplates have a big round hole in the middle of them where they screw onto the lathe. So I turned a piece of wood that's exactly the same diameter as that hole in the middle of the faceplate, and I drilled a hole through that and put a screw in that. So now when I want to mount a faceplate on something, I just put my little round turned piece of wood in there, screw that piece down, drop the faceplate over that peg, and boom, it's right where you want to be. I can mount a faceplate faster than any sighted person can, because they spend all this time dinking around, measure, make sure they got it in the right spot, draw lines. So there's two really good examples of things that I've learned how to do that I think make me a better woodworker, and both of them were inspired by the fact that I can't do it the way the rest of the people do.
That's a very good point. Last little one there. I like that. That's a great way to mount a faceplate. It is.
Faceplates are a pain in the butt to mount, you know?
They are. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so just make yourself either find a dowel that's the right size, or turn yourself a piece that fits in the hole in the middle of your faceplate, drill a hole in the center of that. When you got it on the lathe, run a screw through there. You know, you just put the mark where you want it to be, put that on there, drop your faceplate and screw it down. Boom, you're up and going. I mean, it's quick. I showed that to my student today in the shop. He was talking about doing something. He says, you know, mounting a faceplate on a piece, he says, that it's a pain in the butt. He says, especially if it's an irregular piece. And I says, well, why is that? And he says, well, you got to kind of shift it around and everything. And I says, all you really need to know is where dead center is. He says, yeah, but how do you line it up on the center? There's a hole in the middle. And I showed him mine, and he was just dumbfounded. He says, that's way too easy.
That's very true. It sounds like an excellent way to do it. So anybody else have something that didn't work out?
Oh, we don't want to go there.
Well, that's the purpose of this call. One of them anyway. I will go ahead and tell you. And there's nothing wrong with this thing, this tool that I bought. It is a tenon cutting jig for the table saw. It's made out of cast iron. It weighs at least 25 pounds. Would make an excellent boat anchor. And it does work. But it is so way more complicated than it really needs to be. There are so many easier ways to cut tenons. And this thing sits up on my shelf and it gets moved every now and then when I'm trying to find something else. And I keep saying, why do I still have this? You know, I bought that. I remember buying it because it was on sale, kind of a clearance thing. I think I only paid like maybe $40 for it, which is still a lot of money for something I don't ever use. I mean, I actually got it to cut tenons one time, but the setup on it is so long and tedious to get it everything lined up so that you cut your tenon and not your blade. So that's probably the one I always remember because I don't really have a good place to hide it. It just kind of sits there by my table saw and I wish it was somewhere else. So
is this one of the old Stanley ones or is this someone else's knockoff?
I don't really remember the brand, but like I said, this thing is huge, big piece of cast iron, and you can adjust it. You can do angles and things like that, but you can't do anything too much. You know, it'll adjust a little bit, but mostly it's just for cutting those little slices off the edge of your board on a table saw. And it does work for that. I'm not saying it doesn't, but it's just got so many quirky adjustments to it. If anything gets out of alignment, you'll spend more time getting it all squared back up than it would be to just go over. And I just, you know, I cut tendons. I either use the router table, or I can even mount a damn dado set in my table saw and just cut them flat quicker than I could set this thing up. So
yeah, George.
Yes, sir.
You may have remembered there was a box there with that tenon setup at Blind Incorporated.
Yep. At Blinding. Yep.
Yeah, it reminds me of setting up a radio arm saw after 10 kids have used it, you know. Nothing against kids, but...
You are never, ever, ever done adjusting a radio arm saw.
Yeah, and I took out that tenon cutter, and I set that up. It took me, I don't know, I didn't have students for a couple hours, and it took me all of that just to get going on it. And then, yeah, I hear you, Daryl. Boat anchor.
It's interesting. And again, I think they made it to, you know, like I said, it'll cut tenons on angles. It'll do all kinds of things. But mostly we just want to cut a simple tenon. And I think it takes more time to do that than it ever would be worth.
I will tell you from my experience with those, it's a production tool. It's designed to, I mean, this sounds really weird, but it's designed to take a long time to set up to get it exactly perfect. And they think once you get it set up and run, you're going to run 100 aprons on it, you know, or 100.
Yeah, I can see that. That's probably very true. But, you know, it's doesn't belong in the hobbyist woodworking category, you know.
I own one, and I only get it out when I want to do a lot of pieces because it takes way too long to set it up. I cut almost all my tenons on the bandsaw. Set up the fence, set up a stop, and a really sharp bandsaw blade, preferably one with maybe 12 teeth per inch or something like that, so you get a really fine, crisp cut, not a 3-tooth per inch something, or not a resaw blade.
Right.
And you can really do great tenons on the bandsaw. Just it requires you making, you have to do the cuts coming in from the end, and then you have to somewhere go back and make what is the shoulder cut. You can either do that back on the table saw is where I generally do it. I make all my cuts coming in from the end on the bandsaw, then I go back to the table saw, and I always use a little shoot board to set up to do the shoulder cuts because it'll push that extra little piece beyond the blade every time. So those little bastards don't come back and fly across the room.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, that's just a really good way to do it. They need to fit, but they don't have to be necessarily pretty and smooth and all that stuff most of the time.
Actually, I think the bandsaw ones probably give you more spots in there to, you know, for the glue. I mean, if I was thinking about, you know, all those little tiny ridges, you know, it gives you a lot of glue surface in there.
It really does, yeah.
Do you think anybody sleeps at night wondering how their mortise and tenon is on their bed frame? I mean, it's hidden.
I could make some really inappropriate comment about this, but I'm not going to do that.
Wrong mortise and tenon, George.
Jeff, I'm going to think about it now.
Oh, we digress here so easily.
Sorry, Leslie.
It's okay.
It's amazing how far we can digress.
A split second.
Oh, I've seen these people go down to a 3,000 saying that how much space you need for glue, and I'm thinking, wow, really?
Jeff, these guys who use playing cards as shims to shim their mortises for cutting them. So you take and you have your jig and you put maybe two playing cards in there. And if that's too tight, then you remove one of the playing cards and then you try your cut again. And so you think that may be overkill? I see guys doing YouTube videos doing that kind of stuff. And that just, it drives me nuts. I can't.
A lot of times, some of that stuff is when machinists become woodworkers. Wood just doesn't behave like metal. You know, that's one thing. Hey, Mr. Walker, are you still on here?
I am. I'm still here.
Do you have something, sir?
I do. Years ago, when I was using a lot of sheet goods, I bought a device, supposedly, that I could set a piece of plywood on it and move it around and didn't ruin my back. Well, the thing was about 2 inches left to right, and it had two wheels on it. And the wheels, you know, of course, turned, but they wouldn't swivel. So you'd put the 8-foot sheet of plywood on it and tip it up on these two wheels. The problem with it was for me, where I can't see, I didn't know where I was going with the end of it. And if I would go out to the end of the plywood and try to pull it along, it would tip over. And also, this device was supposedly, once you put the plywood or sheet good on it, you could tip it so the sheet good was horizontal and have the height of this thing adjusted so it could work like as an infeed table for your table saw or to slide sheet goods off onto a bench. Well, that didn't work either, because trying to slide a 4x8 sheet of the plywood off onto a bench, this device would tip over. And I think tried using it once, and now it's sitting out to the side of my workshop, and that's probably where it will remain. It's been there for 4 or 5 years or more, but it sounded like a real good idea until I got it home and tried it, and it didn't work.
I think I bought that exact very same tool as you explained it, and I think used it 2 or 3 times, and then I repurposed the wheels for some other purpose.
I definitely had something similar to that, and it went to junk pile real quick.
Well, a lot of these things, it's funny that we have them, we know that they don't work for us, but I speak for myself. I suppose I shouldn't speak for everybody else, but I just can't seem to part with it. It's just like, you know, I spent money for this, so I should keep it. But it just takes up room in my shop. So I'll give you guys another one. This one is real recent because I bought them just last fall, even after talking to Mr. Walker about them, and because he has them under his workbench too. They're clamps that are designed to clamp the wood together, but also put downward pressure on them. And I bought them. I wish I could tell you the name, but I can't remember it. But they were really expensive. That's another good clue. But you had to make your own wooden blocks to use as the calls. And it does work. The thing about it is that by the time you fuss and fight to get everything lined up, it still never put the pressure. I used it for me. I made a lot of cutting boards last fall. I thought this will be great for keeping all these pieces. I could glue them together and keep them all flat. And not once did I ever have a glue up that came anywhere close to them all being flat. And I can't really figure out how it didn't do it with the way it's designed, but they absolutely, you're just going to lay there under the bench and be useless because they're just, it's one of those things that looks like a great idea, but it just doesn't work.
Well, I got one of those use the tool once projects here. I had 4 holes, 4 1-inch holes. The clearance was like a 5-inch vertical space, 5-inch high space. And I didn't have a right angle drill to be able to get in there. And so I went onto Amazon and I bought this 3 tools in 1 for doing angle cuts or angle drilling. And I ordered that on Friday and it showed up on Sunday. And so that afternoon, I go out in the garage, I chuck it up in my Makita drill, and I put the little hole saw in there, and I go over to drill. I had, again, 4 of these holes to drill, and I was drilling the first hole, and the hole saw just caught just a teeny tiny bit, and the gears in that thing just stripped right out. I didn't even get to drill 1 hole with it, so that was a waste of money.
Yeah, we do have those too. I got another one for you. And I bet you most of us have one of these. And I want to know how many people actually use them. Because I've got 2 or 3 different versions of it. But it's a doweling jig. And I have never gotten dowels to come out straight. But I don't ever use the dowels enough. They're more of a pain than they're ever worth for me, for the most part. Does anybody else have doweling jigs that just sit in their drawer and never get used?
I have a doweling jig, but I actually use it all the time. I love it.
I have one, and I use it a lot. So, and I think it's called, brand name's Dowlet.
The one I have is a Jessam.
There was some doweling jigs out there for a while that Sears sold, and they seem to be kind of ambiguous in all of the Home Depot and those kinds of things. They were absolute pieces of junk. If you can stand the price tag, the cross dowel jig that Woodpecker sells, that thing is a piece of amazing engineering. That's the best doweling jig I think I've ever seen.
I don't own one. I've used one. They just thought about everything on it. It's got abilities to put rods on it so you can set up stops so that when you put it up there, you get it exactly the same distance in from the end every time. It's really, like all their tools, it's really expensive.
Yeah. And Andrew, what you said you had the Jessam?
Yeah, I have the Jessam, the original one. They make one now that's it's a little less expensive. It's made out of some sheet metal, which I heard is decent. But the one I have, I use it all the time. I just love that thing. I think it's the best thing since sliced bread. And on the opposite side of that, I've had a biscuit joiner for 20 plus years. And I bet you I've not used that thing but once in the last 10. That was, I think, a waste of money. I would much prefer to use the dowels as opposed to the biscuits because it's more of a structural fastener.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And I've got also have one of those sitting under the bench. But my problem with the dowels is always getting them centered. If I'm putting two boards together, getting those two boards to be flat when I'm done. I will admit that I never had a good doweling jig. It's always one that costs $30 or less, and they're just, they never work, you know?
The Jessam that I have.
No, I just said that they weren't designed to, those $30 ones. They were just designed to get $30.
Yeah. The Jessam one that I have, I think it cost me $200, and it comes with fixtures to do quarter, 3/8, and 1/2-inch dowels. And I think their design is really innovative in that it has as part of the jig a series of like 5 holes on the 3/8-inch, for instance, where you can drill 5 holes right next to each other. You can do patterned alignment between pieces. And in addition to that, it has a, on the outboard end of where the holes are to run the drill through, it's got a U-shaped groove in it that's about 2 inches long. So if you drill a hole in one board and then you want to drill a hole in the mating board to get it to line up, you basically just clamp the two boards together where you want them to line up. You drill the first board and then you can stick a dowel in it and then you can slide the jig over that dowel in the second board and then drill the first board. And the two will line up perfectly. There is never an error in alignment because it uses the jig itself to align between the two holes that you drill. It's really a very innovative design.
Yeah, that sounds like it.
Yeah, it eliminates all the measuring, which for me is great.
Right, yeah.
That was the reason I never used dowels because I could never get them to line up.
I would love to show you. If we ever have another group meeting, I'll bring my Jessam doweling jig. I think it's the best thing since sliced bread. Mm. I did buy a number of years ago a set of dowel centers where, you know, the idea was you drill one board and then you put these little pins in the hole that you drilled and it's got a point on the opposite side and you can push the boards together and it'll like center punch for the other hole. I've had those things for a decade and I have never used them. I think they were a complete waste of money.
And that's interesting because I have some of those and I use them a lot.
Really? What do you use them for?
I have become a one dowel and an apron or something where you would normally put, you know, two dowels or maybe if it's a big apron, you'd put three dowels in. I have become a one dowel person.
Okay.
I will drill my first hole for my dowel in one of the pieces and then I lay them down flat and then I take a bar clamp and they say tap on it. Tapping on it's the worst idea anybody ever came up with because when you tap on it, it always wants to jump it, you know, make it move. You know, it doesn't do it. But if you put a bar clamp on it or a clamp on it and pull that together and make that other dimple, you know, with the bar clamp, then drill that second hole in there, the mating hole for your dowel, that works out real good. And then I use pocket screws because getting a second dowel to line up lots of times is that's where you start getting into troubles, getting those two dowels to do what you want it to do. So I have gotten so I put one dowel in and then put a pocket screw in. Then you get the strength benefit and the location benefit of a dowel. And then you get the ability for that pocket screws, the Craig jig to, you know, put a screw in there and pull that joint together. That's my preferred way to, if I'm not going to do mortise and tenon, that's the way I put stuff together now. If it's something that has a strength component to it, especially.
Okay. I guess I'm a little spoiled with that Jessam jig that I have. It really handles.
I've seen that jig. I've never used it. I always thought it was a really cool jig.
Yeah, it's a great design.
I have a croissant table I made, and I used biscuits, and now I'm going to have this anxiety thinking, oh my God, I didn't use dowels.
Those darn biscuits are strong, I tell you.
Well, the glue's stronger, I think, so.
Yeah.
I mean, nowadays, I put Type On 3 and 2, but they're both pretty good. I put these branches inside the butterfly houses as little, like, climbing walls on the inside. And I had to move one because I couldn't shut the door after they all dried. And I went in there, I grabbed it, and I was going to snap it off, and I hit it, and it's like, oh my gosh, I could not believe the strength on cedar, because cedar soaks in pretty good. I was very impressed at how much force I needed in a maul to knock that thing off. It was impressive, the glue.
Biscuit cutters. There's a tool that part of the reason that we all hate them as blind people is you have to try to figure out a way to line up the little lines. You draw the line on the two pieces, and then you put your biscuit in on one piece. Then you have to come back over to the other piece and line the line up on the center of your biscuit cutter and make the corresponding cut. We can't see them at the line, so then we're measuring from the edge of the biscuit cutter over to the edge of the board and, you know, trying to get them exactly in the same place. And I admit, I have used a lot of, I put a lot of stuff together with biscuits and use them as location devices mostly. But I have a slotting router bit, a router bit that you set up that has a bearing on the bottom of it that has a little tiny saw blade on it that will cut a, you know, quarter inch deep slot. You can buy them in different, you know, you can get them in different depths, but you can buy the same thickness slotting bit as the saw blade that's in the biscuit cutters. So we use it all the time is when you want to put a wooden edge on a piece of plywood. The biscuits are a perfect way to do that, except for it's a real pain in the ass to line up all the little marks. But if you take your slotting bit in your router and you set that up and you run a continuous groove on the edge of the piece of plywood that you want to put a solid wood edge on, and then you take your biscuit cutter and you set that up so that it is coming down, you know, the exactly the same distance from the top. You can randomly put biscuits wherever you want in the solid wood piece you're going to put on there. And no matter where you put it up there, because you have a continuous groove that goes right in there, and it does exactly what you're really trying to strive to do, is make the top edge of that solid wood piece meet up with the top edge of your piece of plywood as perfect as possible, so you don't sand through the veneer on your plywood when you want to make them flush. That's the best thing I've ever found to do with biscuit cutters.
Could you just use the slot cutter on both of them?
You could, except for there's no reason to make that great big huge long slot and take up all that time, you know, making it on both pieces. And you don't need a spline. You could do that. I mean, there are people do that all the time. They do spline and joints all the time. But I found that this just works really fast for doing exactly that task I was talking about, is putting solid wood edge on a piece of plywood. I can tell you, back to the other reason for using the biscuit cutter on the solid wood edges, when you try to run those long, you know, you may have a 12-foot piece or 10-foot piece, you know, that you're running through your table saw to put that, you know, the other groove in that or your spline, those pieces flex a lot more. And trying to balance the router on a little 3/4 inch wide piece of wood to run it along or use the table saw, that joint then doesn't necessarily come out perfectly parallel with the edge, where when you put the biscuit cutter up there and do it, you're dealing in one little tiny narrow spot, and you can almost always get that biscuit cutter exactly the right depth down from the top edge, if that made any sense to you.
If I'm putting together a tabletop and say I have 4 or 5 boards that are going to be biscuited together, I'll set up my, I got 4 different click rulers, so I'll just set them up intermittently, X plus another 12 inches or whatever, and then hopefully I always measure from the same end of the boards.
Yeah, but there you go.
That's where I use that blue tape, and I put 1, then I put 2 pieces, then 3 pieces, 4, and then I go down. I got tape all over the place when I'm doing that, but then I set up my click rulers, and I start the process of, since I have to do them all, I do all the first cuts first. Boom, boom, boom. Yep. And then I move down and do it again and again. Yeah, every once in a while you make that random one and you go, oh, crap. And then you get a double wide one. But yeah, it's a pain, but yeah, I think it's easy. I mean, it's the only way I got to do it, really. So it works. It's therapy.
After I gave up on the doweling and I bought the biscuit cutter, and I never cared for it. So I splurged and bought a domino.
Oh dear. Okay. Do you like it?
Oh goodness.
I do.
You're $1,000 poorer.
Yeah. Well, that's my tool junkie.
Yeah.
But with the domino, you can change the width of the cut. So you can go down one side of a board with its exact same width as the domino, just barely fits in. Then on the opposing board, you can make it cut just a little bit wider, so you don't have to worry about them lining up.
I have always wanted to try one of those and could never get myself to pull the trigger on the cost.
Yeah, they're it's kind of like woodpecker's tools. They're all too damned expensive, but they are nice.
Well, I fell into that trap with the saw stop. I didn't want to spend the money, but I did, and I'm so thankful that I did. It's the best thing.
That's just a darn good saw on top of it. I mean, the saw stop feature aside, that is one darn good table saw.
Yes, it is.
So if any of you are looking for planer joiners, this is not a commercial because they do give me money. Rycon just came out with a brand new planer joiner. They're doing it in a 12-inch and a 16-inch planer joiner that is, if anybody is familiar with Hung Austria, the absolute Rolls-Royce of woodworking machinery, the people from Rycon took the Austrian machine over to Taiwan to their factory, and they just tore it apart. No, it's, I own two of their pieces of machinery. But anyways, they just knocked it off. I mean, and it's one third of the price, and it is a segmented, spiral head in the joiner. The cutters are single use, but you can rotate them so that you, when you want to sharpen, all you do is pull the old ones out, throw them away and buy new ones and put them in. So, and spiral head. So It runs quieter, when you're using the joiner aspect of it, the pieces push a lot easier. Felder is the name of the company, the Austrian company. The combo machine, Jeff, that I own, that's a joiner, planer, shaper, that's their piece of equipment. But this thing, if you're looking for a new planer joiner, this is the cat's meow. And like I said, it's one third the price of the Felder piece. It is a beautiful, they just showed it at the show. First time a month ago when I was over in Hickory. Anybody's looking for a new planer joiner? I know Jeff just bought a brand new planer.
Mm-hmm.
Yours has a helical head in it too, right?
Yeah, I really like it. You can take, there's 45, I believe it's 45 teeth in there.
Yeah.
Kind of like a staircase setup, yep. Spiral. But each one on this one has four sides, so there's no indexing. You loosen the screw, you lift it up, you turn it once, you can turn it four times because it's a square and it's all sharpened. That's pretty neat. And I ran some boards through it, and it was just like, whoa, it's pretty cool.
Did you get your dust collector to go with it?
Not yet. That goes on sale tomorrow, I guess. Black Friday. I've been looking at them, but I'm not going to be doing an extensive amount of board feet through that thing. I'm going to do some. And so I just hooked up my shop vac to test it because it already has a little blower on it. So I just cleaned off a board just to see how smooth the cut was going to be and to see if it worked before the warranty ran out, the return date, I guess. And it worked out really good. So I just added on this little coupling that knocked it down to the size for my shop vac, which I know isn't the best thing to use for extensive use, but I see that they have a jet 1.5 horsepower. I believe it's 15 amp, 115 volt. It only gets, they say 735, but those numbers that they have for that sucking power, it depends on if it's wide open, just sitting there, or if you reduce it down from 6 inches to 4 inches. And then, so you never know what really number that you're going to get. But I say, if you got that on wheels and you only have a 8-foot vacuum hose going to it, flexible, I think you're pretty good, especially if you have a cyclone attachment on it as well. I'm not going to be running 8-hour shift.
I own that exact model, and it is wonderful. I really, really like it. And I bought it to go along with the 13-inch DeWalt planer. That was the first thing that I bought when I came back from Enchanted Hills when I was up there. It's like, I've got to have a planer. So I bought that, and then I bought that jet dust collector, and they both, it was one of the best investments I've ever made.
Yeah, they got 15% off coming up here.
Those canister filters are huge, but they do work. I don't have any dust floating around in the shop. So
They say it's, is that what it is? 0.5 milli?
0.5.
0.5 micron.
I mean, they do make the 2 horsepower, but then you're talking 220. Then there's a 3 horsepower. But, you know, I say for your typical shop, I think that's enough, a 1.5 horsepower.
I've got an old jet in my shop that was the 2-bag variety, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But the CFM's about the size. I got plastic pipe running up the wall across the ceiling. All my tools are hooked to it. Is if you're just doing one, you know, one blast gate at a time, or mine, I got it actually split into 2 zones. It does a good, very good job. It doesn't get everything, but it gets 98% of the wood chips, you know?
Yeah.
Mistake that most people make with blast gates is that they put the blast gate near the end of the run closest to the machine. And really where you want your blast gate to be is you want it to be as close to your trunk run as you can possibly get it. Because when you make those big, long runs coming off your whatever your trunk line is.
Oh, yeah.
And you got that big, empty space in there. So it wants to create a vacuum in those spaces. And you lose a lot of the power of your vacuum. So sometimes it's just not convenient for them to be up there, you know, near the trunk run if you run it up along the ceiling or something. But the closer you can get your blast gates to the source of the vacuum to turn your lines off, the better vacuum you'll get. The biggest mistake most people make with a vacuum, they think that if they turn off all of the blast gates in their system and only run the one that's going to their machine, if the machine is designed, if your vacuum is designed for an 8-inch inlet or a 6-inch inlet into your machine, and you choke down all of your pipes so that you're just running 1 4-inch outlet, you know, at one machine and you have everything turned off. Actually, if you go and open up one of your other outlets, you'll actually increase the amount of airflow that you can get because the machine is designed to move X amount of cubic feet through the fan. And if you're not moving the amount of cubic feet of air through the fan that it's designed to pull, it's restricting the amount of air coming in. It actually lowers the amount of suction you have on that one outlet. It seems counterintuitive, but you know the impeller is designed to move X amount of air. And if you can't bring it that much air, it then lowers the amount of air that it's pulling from, you know, whatever device you have.
That's why my shop is basically out of a 6-inch inlet. It comes out to 2 fours, but though I always leave, those zones are always open at some place, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, I just wanted to get something because I didn't use mine during the winter that often, and I plan on using it more, and I just didn't want to start pissing pulp, you know what I mean?
It's nice to keep the shop clean too, you know?
Yeah.
Anybody else have an item that maybe didn't work out or one that really did?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about all the stuff in my shop, and I was actually thinking about it this week, and I've done pretty good, you know, with asking questions to you guys and asking George and talking, you know, the West and, you know, all these resources that we have nowadays and all that. I don't feel bad about buying a tool that I use once or twice, like my oscillating tool. Do I use it a lot? No. But when there's a nail where a reciprocating saw won't work, or there's a certain situation where you're in a jam or a corner somewhere and you just need to remove a nudge, or whatever you want to call it, a nodulin, it comes in handy. And like a sheetrock screw gun, who needs a special sheetrock screw gun? Well, you know what? All these tools that we do have that some people say, well, you only use it once or twice. Well, on that day you got it and you used it, you're happy. I mean, you're glad. And when you come into that situation again, you're glad you have it. So I don't feel bad about having some tools that look brand new still, but they're waiting. They're there. And it's a nice option. A lot of my friends, I don't like borrowing tools out, but they know I have stuff. And if they come over to help, there's options. And I like that. I really do. I used to feel bad about spending $150 on a right angle drill. But when I went up in the Joyce's this last year and had to do, I don't know, 16, 20 holes, oh, those are handy, handy as heck. And I got these new little short auger bits instead of spades. These short auger bits, they just, wow, they just you know, just they just go. I like the sound effects. they just bore right through, and it's like there's no sudden jerk at the end that'll break your wrist. Nothing like that. You know, get a spade bit on some of that stuff, and you have no room to get in between a joist. So that's why I got the right angle. Then I got those auger bits, and they came in a set, and I love them. I do.
You know, I just used my multi-tool for the first time in about 3 years, but I got six doorways going down my hallway, which gets this new flooring, and I had to cut every one of those damn
door jams. Yeah. It's a jam saw. It's a beautiful little jam saw.
Yep. Does a good job, especially, you know, you can't see.
Did you duct tape a little block of wood to the back of it so that it sits perfectly level on the floor?
I used a board that I laid down.
Ah, okay.
Blade to blade right on top of the board. So I got a half inch on every one of them. A couple of them, I tell you something, this is a tool that everybody should have, and it's called the Japanese back saw.
Oh, my gosh.
Especially a flush trim saw. I got to tell you that it made a lot quicker work out of some of those than that multi-tool. It did just the nicest job using it flat on that same board, because yep. Four or five pulls on that thing and it was off. You got to have one of those guys in your shop. You just beautiful things.
Keep hearing about these Japanese saws, little hand saws.
Well, a normal saw, a Western saw, you push down on the cut stroke is pushing down. A Japanese saw, the teeth are coming back towards you. So you cut on a pull. So that number one, it's much easier to control. But really, it's just a super sharp, really thin blade that will cut just most wood like butter. And it tends to want to go straight, you know, when you're pulling it. Kind of like using a hacksaw. You know, a hacksaw is really designed to be used on the pull cut. And it just cuts a lot straighter when you do that. If you're pushing down, you kind of tend to push it one way or the other, side to side. Where pulling, you don't. These saws don't have very much of a handle. They just have like a round handle that just sticks out. But I tell you, I wouldn't have my shop without one, because there again, don't use it all the time. But when you need it, or if you want to follow, like I have to do this sometimes, notch a block or something, you know, I can clamp a block up there as a guide, and this little saw will run right down that block perfectly. It just makes a beautiful straight cut.
The other thing about them is that the set on the tooth is to the interior. An American saw, the set on the tooth goes to the outside of the blade, so that if you're looking at the blade and the teeth, you know, and you have it sticking so the teeth are facing the ceiling and you're looking down at it, you'll have a tooth that has a set to it that sticks off to the right on a little angle, and then there'll be a raker tooth. Then you have it on the opposite side, you have a tooth that sets off the other direction, and that's what does the cutting. On a Japanese saw, they angle the set on the teeth to the middle of the piece of steel so that you can run a Japanese saw right flush against something and it won't make marks if you run it in your hand real smooth, but it won't make any marks on the piece that it's up against. With the big differences in how and why they can get them so sharp, American saw blades, they temper the saw blades and then they go through and sharpen and set all the teeth on them. On the Japanese saws, they go in and they sharpen their Japanese saws in soft metal, and then they temper the whole thing. So you cannot sharpen a Japanese saw. You buy them, and when they become dull, you throw that blade away and you buy another new blade. They're pretty inexpensive, but they can get them so much sharper. I mean, they get them so much sharper.
Yeah, it's just about like cutting with a razor sometimes. And I guess because the way that those teeth are set, your kerf is really thin.
Really thin. And I don't know if you've ever done this, but if you ever hit a nail or a staple with a Japanese saw, the teeth just start falling off like rain. It's really bizarre. Once you break the tempering that's on those teeth, it's really weird. The teeth just start falling off one after the other.
Yeah, that's why I'm on my second one.
Yeah, see, it's really weird. It just, I mean, you would think, no, there's no way it would do that. Where an American saw, it just kind of dings them up and you go back and resharpen them. But Japanese saw, you hit a nail or a staple with them and the teeth just start falling off.
I got another tool that I think one of the things is when I was teaching at Blind Incorporated, it came with a lot of tools. And I really got back into woodworking when I got there because they showed me a click ruler. And boom, 4 months later, I'm teaching. Well, I got to experiment a lot of tools and I started replicating what I wanted. I found out what I wanted. But I got these clamps, and I don't know the name of them. You all know the name of them. They're these big wood things, about 12 inches. There's two of them, and then there's two screws that go through that oppose, and they have handles on it, and you spin the whole thing, and it gets tighter and looser. What are those called?
Parallel jaw clamps. Wooden parallel jaw clamps.
Those things are designed to make smart people look stupid sometimes. Because it takes a minute. You go like this, and then you do this, and then you get going on it, and it's fine. But I've probably used them a handful of times. But for the last 8-9 years, I think they're just around.
George, what do you call those clamps that you had at Napa that are like one-handed? You can use it one-handed, and it had the wood, like cam lever?
Yeah, those are Swedish. Those are Swedish cam lock. It's exactly what they're called. Swedish cam lock clamps.
Those are good.
And those have leather faces on them. Those wooden clamps with leather faces on them. And you can't get a huge amount of pressure with them, but they are so handy. I mean, I use those things perpetually. They leave no marks. You can't get a huge amount of pressure with them. 99% of the time, you don't need a huge amount of pressure. I have a lot of pipe clamps in my shop, and I have a lot of pipe clamps that are on the half-inch diameter iron pipe. And people look at those and say, well, I don't like those because they bend when you really start cranking on them. I says, if you really have to start cranking them, your piece really wasn't designed to go together.
And you call that a Swedish what?
It's a Swedish cam clamp.
Cam clamp. Okay.
Yeah. Wooden cam clamp.
And you can find those at most places?
Well, no. I'll tell you where I have seen them is Highland Hardware in Atlanta, Georgia. They sell them there.
Okay.
That's the only spot off the top of my head. Lee Valley Tool might sell them too, but I know Highland Hardware sells them.
Yeah, I loved using them up there at Napa, and I've never been able to find them. I didn't know what to look for.
I bought a whole box of 100 of them when I bought those. It was in the Corian business, and lots of times you need to clamp things in the Corian business. It doesn't require a lot of pressure because because of the kind of glue and stuff you use and how you machine Corian together and everything. But they're perfect because they don't leave a blemish, they don't leave a mark, and they give you just exactly the right amount of pressure.
I'm surprised a lot of you didn't talk about dovetail jigs.
Oh my God.
Just saying.
I have a dovetail jig and I love it, but I don't use it as often as probably the investment merits.
What brand?
It's a Lee, the DR4 Pro.
There you go. Yeah, it's the only one to own.
What is that? The Lee what?
DR4 Pro. So it's a fully adjustable dovetail jig. You can do randomly spaced, randomly sized dovetails.
Out in Napa out there, and the first time we used it, got on the horn with the guy from Lee, you know, the customer support guy. And he was all wigged out at first. You're blind and you're going to use this? And we go, yeah, we are. We're going to.
Yeah, that was quite the busy activity in that area. A lot of chiefs were in that room.
Speaking of that place, food for future, very relatively near future thought, like within the next year and a half, I do believe that the Enchanted Hills is going to be looking for a industrial arts instructor, and it will probably be a pretty good paying job, and it comes with lodging and everything. I may be jumping the gun, but I don't think I am. They've been talking to me about coming out, doing some consulting and getting it set up and running and everything. Someone gave some money, so now they got to spend it.
Rattlesnakes, bobcats, mountain lions.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Forest fires.
They're only 70 pounds, but they go for the jugular.
Yeah, I heard Enchanted Hills just got a new director.
I have.
Not a new director, a new land management guy or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Tony's still out there.
Yep. I guarantee you we're going to be back there sometime in the not too distant future. It's in the works right now. I don't have dates set up yet, but.
I love that place. It was an excellent spot.
I'm going out right after the first of the year, we'll meet with Jamie Gump, and we're going to put it together. Jerry Koontz is a heavy hitter out there, and he told them they're going to do something with it, and they listened to Jerry. So,
yeah, I got a question for most of you. I'm reaching this point that my wood shop is my little therapy, I guess. You go out there and you tinker and stuff like that, where you're not under the watch of a supervisor or you're not working. You're kind of creative and you're doing things that you want to do and you spend money on tools and you enjoy it. And I guess that's the recipe I'm talking myself right into, is that's why I do it. It's kind of interesting. You see a lot of people, you know, they could buy this because they're going to produce this and the money coming back. And no, it's not about that. I think it's more about being creative and having the right tools to do what you want to do. And I don't know.
I mean, absolutely is for me. I really don't ever wanted to make anything to sell, you know, or make something for somebody else mm-hmm. because people are just a pain in the butt, you know, but I make it for my kids or it just gives me a creative outlet.
I think what Jeff is really trying to say is Lori works from home.
Does she send you no, out from the
shop? No, it's not really that. It's what, Dennis?
Does she send you to the shop?
No, I usually try to justify purchases and if I got to get a new computer or a new anything like that. But it's like out in the shop, it's like, why did I get the planer right now? I don't have the dust collector yet. So that'll come. That'll all come. And it just gives you that option to make a nice lid for a small box project that we might have in the future. We haven't had one for Christ 2 months. So, you know, stuff like that. It just gives you options. And I wanted that option because I always had a planer over at Blind Incorporated where George has one. You know, it's just one of those things. We want one.
Oh, yeah. I tell people this all the time. You don't have to furnish your entire shop at one time.
No. I'm on 20 some years now.
Yeah, me too.
Someone was on the list a couple of weeks ago and was talking about snipe on their planer.
That's me.
Yeah. And I will tell you that some of the lesser expensive planers, you know, they skip putting the chip breakers and the pressure bars in them. And so you can't get the clamped down tight enough. But the biggest factor is getting those table rolls, you know, the rollers that are in the table if they have them. Getting those suckers adjusted to exactly the right height. They need to be like only like 5/1000ths above, you know, the bed. I mean, that's the key right there. When you run a board across there, a nice, really flat board across there, they should just barely turn that roller that's in the bottom. Because if those rollers are up above the lower bed level at all, you're going to get snipe on your pieces.
I brought it up because I have the DeWalt 735 and Andrew will tell you it never gets snipe. And I've only had this thing, since last fall. So I've had it about, but my old Rigid hardly ever gave me snipe. This thing hardly ever does not give me snipe. And I've tried to adjusting those tables every which way you could possibly adjust them. It got better because if I plane only on the slow speed, it will do better. But if I plane a 1/4-inch piece, or 3/8 or less, it starts chattering and it will just tear up the top of the board, which I know is not normal.
To me, that sounds like not enough pressure on the infeed roll. The infeed roll is set too high. You need to lower the infeed roll. If you're getting chatter, it's almost always, and I don't know if that little machine has a pressure bar in it, right? If there's a flat bar that runs against the wood when you open it up, if you look in, if you're coming in from the outfeed side, you should find the outfeed roller. And then there should be a little steel bar that's between that and the head, okay? If that particular planer has that bar in there, and that's a spring-loaded bar, the same as the outfeed and infeeds are, okay? So that bar can move up and down just a micro amount. And if that bar is not tight against the wood, that absolutely will give you chatter. If the infeed roller is set too high, so it's not giving enough pressure down, it still may be feeding because it's got a good coarse, you know, roller on it or a rubberized roller or whatever, but it may not be holding the piece down tight enough against the table.
Well, that's what I think it is. But okay, I read this manual front to back. I don't see any place where it says I can adjust it.
I'm not very familiar with that little planer.
I think I just got a lemon. That's what I think. Because if you go out and search the web, nobody has complained about this thing's been out there for 30 years, I think, just about.
Yeah.
And nobody's complaining about it, but I'm complaining about it.
Call up their customer service. They got relatively good customer service. Ask them about it. I mean, they're going to have a database of all the people that have ever bitched. So
yeah, I've tried that. We'll try it again. It's just getting to a real person, you know, it's a challenge.
Not because they give me money. But I will tell you, if you're looking for a company that has customer service, Rikon is it. Maybe you get a real person that knows shit. They're a little tiny company that's owned by two guys, you know. So you really get customer service out of those guys. If anybody's looking to buy a drill press, Rikon just, here again, I'm talking about Rikon. They just came out with a radial arm drill press. And you can get 24 inches between the post and the bit on that radial arm drill press. And it's only like $500. And you can rotate the head right and left too. So you can, you know, the head moves back and forth away from the column that holds it up, and the head will rotate right and left as well. So you can angle those.
So you get a click ruler behind it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got to have room behind it for the motor to back up on it. Yeah.
Does it have a variable frequency drive to adjust the speed?
I know it has a stepped pulley on it because knowing Rikon like I know Rikon, it might have both. It might have a step pulley and a variable frequency drive on it both. But it definitely has a stepped pulley on it, you know, so you can adjust the speeds on it.
Right.
I always hate that when you set something up on the drill press, you're measuring from the front, everything good, so you want to see if it's centered. You flip click ruler around to the back and you hit the post.
Hit the post.
It's like, I should have started cockeyed.
Yeah.
But how many times do you start out cockeyed? You know, you just straight, you know?
It just depends on who you are, I guess.
Well, my drill press sits against the wall, so I don't want to be too cockeyed because there's other things around, you know? I want to be straight feed, left, right, if I have a 3-foot board, maybe, you know? So then all of a sudden you realize after you set it all up, you have to, well, I get away with it. Just some of those things.
So if anybody's looking for those clamps that George and I were talking about, they don't come up as Swedish. They come up as wooden cam clamps. I put in Swedish cam clamps and came back zero results.
Wooden cam clamps.
Did Highland Hardware come up?
This is Lee Valley.
Oh, Lee Valley. See, I said Lee Valley or Highland Hardware, so okay, good.
Does anybody purposely go out and get a Forester blade anymore?
Yeah, I just bought that.
I have a bunch of Forest blades in.
Did you get the Workmate? Is it the Workmate?
The Woodworker 2.
Woodworker 2, yeah.
Yeah, Woodworker 2,
They're great blades. I think they're super high quality.
Mm-hmm.
Someone had mentioned Ridge Carbide earlier in the call, and I hear they're also very good blades, but I've used the Forest blades for years. Have always had very good luck.
That's a great blade.
Yeah, you know, they charge for them, but I think my oldest one is probably more than 10 years old, and I just, every year or two, I send it back and get it sharpened. It costs me, you know, $25 or something.
You start looking at carbide blades. There's the thing you'll figure out really fast when you start looking at the amount of carbide that's on the blade. There's the thing right there. That's why some of them, you know, are $30 and some of them are $100. You can sharpen the $100 blade, you know, 10 times. You can sharpen the $30 blade one time or two times if you're lucky.
Yeah.
Veneer carbide.
I hope to get Ridge Carbide just to talk about, because they have, I don't know, they have a ton of blades on their site, just to talk about all the different kinds of blades. But I paid $160 for this blade, which goes to my new saw. But that's the only blade I've had. Circular saw blades, all the blades you could think of, round blades. I've never once had one of them poke me and make me bleed. The tooth die is so sharp, that point made me bleed, and it's like, damn, I have never seen that before. Handling, it's the only blade where I changed it today because I'm going to cut all this flooring, and I'm not going to use my new good blade to do it. I changed it. It's the only blade I make sure I don't ever touch those damn teeth with my hand, because
yeah,
those things are super sharp. And if you're going to have a saw stop, you have a good blade.
When you're talking about cutting your planks on the table saw, are you using a sled?
For the cross cuts, yeah, I did today.
Is that a handmade sled?
Yep. It took me, I don't know. For whatever reason, I fought that sled for on and off probably 10 hours total before I finally got it, but it cuts dead perfect square. You know, I've just learned over the years, just like my old saw, it did a nice job of cutting, but it just wasn't good enough because it would just do quirky things where I could never really get a straight ripped cut. Well, I've learned that you want a square cut when you're doing things, especially most things. You know, you want a square, dead square cut. And if you don't have a dead, it just aggravates the living crap out of you whenever you're trying to build something.
Like I said, I spent a lot of time tweaking that blade. In fact, I made the, it's a full-size sled. I mean, I have three of them, you know, but this one I just made is a full-size sled, and it has a removable insert in it, so it stays zero clearance on me. And that that seemed like a great idea when I was doing it, and it works, but I think I wasted a lot of time for something I didn't really, I think I could have got that tape put on there. Probably would have been easier.
Yeah, it's all part of the game.
It's worth having one, though. If you want accurate cuts, you got to have one. I think I'm going to have to get off here, guys.
Yeah, I'm out of beer.
Thanks, everybody, for joining tonight.
Well, thanks, everybody. It was great hearing stories and chats and tips and tricks and stuff.
Absolutely.
This is where it comes from.
Thank you all.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you, everybody.
Good night, Jeff. I miss you.
Miss you too, Georgie.
Be sure to check out WW4B.org, Woodworkers for the Blind. Become part of the community and learn from others. Hope you enjoyed, and until next time, bye-bye.